Okay. Are there any questions on anything we did last time? Okay. So we were looking at this slide when we ended, and that was regression. Presumably you have no questions on regression also. So we ended with sort of a quick discussion on progression versus regression, which might do well in search. And this is just a recap of some of the points I made last time. Regression has a lower branching factor. Progression has a higher branching factor. So that looks as if that's a good thing for regression. However, interestingly enough, progression searches in the space of complete states. Okay. Regression searches in the space of partial states. We made a big deal about the fact that goal states are partial. And, you know, in fact, I also added a slide after the class on the asymmetry of initial and goal states. We went through all these points. I just put them as a summary there. But we know that goal states are partial, and this is supposed to be a good thing because whether you like it or not, they are partial, first of all, because people just tell you what they want to achieve, you know, rather than telling you the complete world state in which what they are trying to achieve should be true. Okay, so the irrelevant details are never given as part of the goal state. So the tricky thing is that it may be kind of surprising to notice that the number of complete states are how many? If you have k state variables, the number of complete states are how many? 2 power k. Number of partial states are how many? Where partial includes complete, right? I mean, I just said that the goal state can be partial, but sometimes I am actually very picky. I want a specific complete state to be the goal. Okay. So number of partial states you should see is more than the number of complete states. Okay. In particular, actually, you can compute it, okay, because of the way you compute it, 2 power k is because in each state, each literal, I mean, each proposition can be either true or false, and there are k such things, so they're 2 power k possibilities. Now, if you're talking about partial states, what happens is, in the goal state, a literal is mentioned, and you want it to be true. It's mentioned, you want it to be false. It's mentioned, I mean, it's not mentioned at all. It's the third case. So either it's mentioned and you want it to be true, or it's mentioned and you want it to be false, or you don't care about it. So for each literal, really, there are three possibilities now on each state variable. I'm using the word literal to also mean state variable. Okay. So there are three power k partial state. Okay. Here's an interesting point. This is sort of elementary combinatorics. You could think of what's going on here is a goal state is really corresponds to a set of complete states. That we know. Okay. So if you were to compute, let's say, the number of subsets of complete states, the number of subsets of complete states, how much would that be? So there are k states, and there are k state variables. There are 2 power k states. So that set of states is 2 power k size, and you want the subsets, the number of subsets that a set of size 2 power k has. It's 2 power k. Okay. So the total number of sets of states is actually 2 power k. Okay. So in fact, there was a previous version of this slide. In case you actually printed this, you would have seen that I put in a 2 power k, 2 power n as the number of states in which regression search will progress, regression search will happen, okay, because the number, that number comes if you just think about the fact that each regression state corresponds to a subset of world states, and there are 2 power k subsets of world states. However, it turns out that if you look at the way our specific regression algorithm works, it's looking at only a subset of those 2^2 k, because it's only looking at partial states where either a state variable is true or false or missing. That's it. Okay. So those are actually called conjunctive descriptions. And did you do machine learning already? Okay. So you actually know that if you are trying to guess a Boolean function that I have in my head, right, there are 2^2 n Boolean functions. So you die trying to guess it because you need a whole number of samples to figure out which of those 2^2 n functions do I have in my mind. So what do? You make a bias. You say, well, I assume that you have a conjunctive function in your head. A conjunctive function is a conjunction over literal. And in fact, many well-known logical learning algorithms just make this bias, conjunctive function bias. And they do it because suddenly you go from 2^2 n to 3^n. Okay, and if you remember sample complexity stuff, the number of samples you need to learn 2^2 n functions is 2^n samples. Whereas for 3^n, you just need n samples, because it's a log of that. Okay, so there's a lot of interesting connections here between elementary combinatorics, the notion of partial states, which is also connected to the notion of propositional formulas. In fact, let me make one more point here, which is, if you think of state variables as propositions in the propositional logic, right? A complete state is a large conjunctive formula, right? It's a large conjunctive formula over literal, where literal is a proposition or a negation of it. And the total number of complete conjunctive formulas are obviously 2^n. Okay. However, there are many, many more arbitrary logical formulas you can write over n propositions, right? In fact, you can at least write 2^2 n distinct logical formulas. That means they actually have different models. And then many more syntactic variants of those. Okay? So you can actually think of what's going on in this search as manipulating logical formulas. Manipulating logical formulas. Progression manipulates logical formulas which are complete, which are basically complete conjunctions. Regression manipulates logical formulas which are partial conjunctions. In general, you can actually manipulate arbitrary logical formulas. Okay, because if I give you any arbitrary logical formula, it might correspond to a unique set of world states, which is basically the set of models that formula has. Remember the models of logical sentences? And what's a model? A model is a world here. Now, having made this connection between logical formulas and states, you should start wondering about all those worrisome things, such as reasoning with logical formulas can be pretty darn costly. Arbitrary logical formulas can be pretty darn costly, right? In particular, I can give you a logical formula, and it could have zero number of models. It could have zero number of models. That means it is, what is it called then? If a logical formula has no models, then what is it called? Inconsistent. So it entails false. Okay? So now if I give you an arbitrary logical formula and I want you to check whether it actually corresponds to a non-empty set of interpretations, that means it has models. It has models. Do you know how costly that is? So you know the opposite problem, which is, given a set of formulas in propositional logic, I ask you to exhibit a specific interpretation which is a model of that formula. That means give me truth-falsity assignments to all the propositions such that that would be a model of this formula. That's called what problem? Satisfiability problem. Okay? That's a well-known NP-complete problem. Now I'm asking, I'll give you a formula, can you tell me whether it's empty? That means it has no world state consistent with it. that is actually also sort of bad. You know, if one is NP complete, the other one is called co-NP complete. Okay, and it's bad news. So if I give you a random logical formula, you are playing with it without realizing that you have no states that correspond to this logical formula. Why is this whole thing relevant to our discussion? Remember, these are all formulas. These are logical formulas. This is not clear B and hand empty. That's a formula. Here is holding A and clear B. That's a formula. And here is not clear B and holding A. That's a formula. The question is, when I'm trying to expand these nodes forward, it's possible that the node that I have in my hand is already dead. That means there exists no world state that corresponds to the set of world. So basically, each of these represents a set of real world states, except that set can be empty. If the set is empty, is there any point in going forward on that direction? No. Right? So the question is this. In this picture, do you see any state which is dead? I mean, any partial state which is dead? That means the set of real world states that it denotes is actually empty. This is a simple problem. Two blocks, right? And one hand. So the question is there any set here? And there are only three sets here. Is there any set here, any formula here, which is actually empty? That means not clear B holding A. Do people realize that there is no complete world state in this domain where B would be not clear and A can be held? It's not possible. If you think about this domain, there's one hand, two blocks. If the only hand is holding A, then where the heck is B? B is sitting on the table. So B has to be clear. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay? Now, you had trouble for a two-block problem to figure out that this is empty. Okay? What do you think your A-star search algorithm would do? It says, oh, looks good. Let me expand it. And a dead guy begets dead children. Okay? And dead children will beget more dead grandchildren and so on. And you have a huge dead subtree. A huge dead subtree. The way you die in search is exactly this way. You could be generating huge subtrees which are all dead on arrival, but you are blithely, oh, looks good. You know, let's just keep expanding. Okay? Do you understand that point? So, now, of course, you will say, well, you know, big deal. You know, I'll just have a little inconsistency checker, which I give this formula to the checker, and it will tell me whether this such a state, I mean, is there any world state which is consistent with this? Okay? The complexity of that check is exactly the same as the complexity of the overall planning problem in the worst case. Do you understand what I'm saying? So you can, of course, I mean, I'm not saying that you should never try checking for inconsistency, but if you want to develop a procedure that's sound and complete, that means if it says this can be killed and you kill it, you will not lose any solution. And if it says this should not be killed, then in fact there is a possible solution underneath it. To make such a procedure is just as hard as planning. However, suppose I gave you a procedure which if it says this can be killed, you can count on it. You can kill it. But most of the time it won't open its mouth. It will just keep quiet. Okay? That would be a sound but incomplete procedure. It's not capturing all the inconsistencies, but it's capturing some. And that's the best you can hope for when you're doing this kind of planning. Okay? So the kind of what happens for your type of, you know, if you were to write a plan for this in this sort of a domain, what happens is one of these many, many great-great-grandchildren that you found, each of them, they will at some point of time wind up having in the same state not clear B and clear B. At that point, even a dumb search can figure out that I can't make not clear B and clear B true at the same time. And if you don't know how to do that, then you know, you shouldn't be writing programs. Okay. So at that point, you figure that out. What's happening is there's an implicit failure which would take too long for you to figure out, and in some sense, search figures it out for you the hard way. Okay. Now this whole reason, this whole explanation is brought up to point out, first of all, that things can be sort of incompatible with each other without you realizing it. Okay. I mean, clear B, not clear B, incompatible. You realize it. Okay. Not clear B holding A. You didn't realize it. When you guys were here. You are undergrads, you know, smart people. And so it's not obvious. In fact, that there are inconsistencies, implicit inconsistencies that might take too long to figure out. Okay. So if somebody does give you that kind of information, if a friend of yours says, hey, you know, I have a bunch of, you know, pieces of information. These are called what I'll call mutual exclusions. Okay? I spent a lot of time figuring this out for your domain. And this basically say that whenever this formula and this formula are part of your state, you can kill the state because you can't achieve both those things together. You should pay good money to buy them. Okay? Because that can be used to kill this. Okay, that's one point. So knowing mutual exclusions is good because you could use that to cut down failing branches, and the way you succeed is by avoiding failing branches. You know, in fact, the classic point that somebody asked, what's his name? The Linus Pauling, who got 2 Nobel Prizes in science. You know, this is, there are such lunatics in the world. And he got 2 Nobel Prizes, and somebody asked him, so how do you do it? You know, how do you get 2 Nobel Prizes? How do you get so many ideas? He says, well, I get a lot of ideas. I throw away the bad ones. And so he has good ideas. So much of success is throwing away the bad ideas. Much of search is throwing away the bad branches. Okay, so you should pay good money if somebody tells you this information. The second point, of course, which is sort of more relevant to the immediate discussion we are having, is that regression, because it searches in the space of partial states, it might actually be blithely expanding large number of inconsistent states without realizing it. So despite the fact that it has a lower branching factor, it can actually do worse than progression. Progression doesn't have this problem at all. Right? Progression starts with a state, which is a real state, applies a honest to goodness real action, gets an honest to goodness real state. So this state may not be going anywhere you want to go, but at least it corresponds to something real. Okay? Regression, on the other hand, is making you feel good that, wow, you started with these goals and you sub-goaled and you sub-goaled and sub-goaled, you're making good progress, except what you have in your hand is empty sets. Yes?
Well, even on progression, you have places where your actions went through movement. You could do something and say, you know, I'm not going to do the reverse action right after I've taken an action.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have to pick up the and then put the
yes, down. No, I think, okay, so just keep that in mind. So I did say the following thing. All progression can guarantee is that what you have in your hand, there is a path from what you have in your hand to the beginning. And the beginning is a real state. So you are grounded in reality. Now, what you have in your hand, is it going anywhere close to where you want to go? All bets are off. Okay? So in fact, what we just said is, to do good search, you need 2 things. Okay, one is you better be real. That means what you're searching in the space of state that corresponds to some real state, first of all. So it's reachable from the initial state. And it better be relevant. That means whatever you are holding, there is a path from there to the goal state. Now, if you look at these 2 kinds of searches, progression ensures reachability from the initial state because that's how it is generating the search tree. But it has no clue whether any of these states is close to the goal state. It doesn't know anything about relevance. So it has reachability, has no clue about relevance. So if progression should be helped, there's no point in telling progression, hey, look, the state that you have, there is a path from there to the initial state. The search will say, you bozo, I know that. I just generated it. So I know exactly the path. So the useful information you can give to your progression search is that there is a path from where you are to the goal state, and that's about 5 units costly. That's the relevance information. because that's the one that's missing in progression. Now, if you're trying to help regression, on the other hand, it knows relevance. The only things it's generating are relevant states, right? Because it's taking actions which at least do something useful and don't do anything bad, and regressing the state over those actions. So there is a sort of a sub-goaling going on. Everything here is relevant. From here you can go to the goal state. What you have no clue about is whether any of these will get you to the initial state. You need both. Okay? And to improve the search for these planners, you need to figure out how to give either relevance or reachability information. Okay, so this kind of basically brings us to heuristics. So how do we give this relevance and reachability information? That's some sort of heuristic information that you have to give to your planner. So just to give you an idea of how bad would you do if you don't have any heuristic information. So if you were to get a planning project where you write down progression and regression codes and write up a bunch of problems and try to solve them, how do you expect to do without any good heuristic? So this is the state of the art around, I guess, 1995-96, these are the state-of-the-art planners at that time. This is some particular domain, toy domain, called Rocket World, where you have a bunch of rockets on the Earth and a bunch of packages, and then you want to transfer them to Moon, which is completely different from trucks and boxes. You notice that, and it has the word rocket in it. And you notice that the way the planners were doing is, the way the planners were doing is, they're all miserably bad. Of course, you can still write papers. You say, I'm less miserably bad than the other guy. Okay? Success is just being better than your loser opponent. Why is Google doing so much better in search engines? It's not because it's actually giving what you're looking for. It's because everybody else does even worse job of giving you anything, that you're just so happy. You're actually very easy to please. And Google does epsilon better than the rest of them, and that's it. They win. There's no point in actually doing what it takes to do full web search, because that would be too long, and somebody else would have beaten you to the punch. So you just do, that was for the next release. So the idea, of course, was we basically were writing planners, and you notice that, look, mine is so much better than these losers, because they're going even more exponentially higher. Okay, so now we have planners which basically generate much, much larger plans. So the number of steps in the plan in that previous case, which is sort of equal to the depth of the search tree, is of the order of 5, 6, 7 steps. So you can go 5 deep and you die. That's because B is large. Branching factor is large, and B power 5 can start getting onto your nerves. Okay? Right now, on the other hand, this is a sort of an encoding of the operations of Munich Airport as used in the international planning competition as of 2002, I believe. Okay? And the important thing to note is actually this, the number of tasks is not even the number of steps. The number of tasks the number of steps is sort of like multiple of the number of tasks. So we are talking about hundreds of steps in the plan. Hundreds of steps in the plan. So hundreds deep search, okay, being done under, look at this y-axis, 0.01, 0.11, and so on. So and very fast. And if you want to consider comparing it to the previous one, these were 5, 10, etc. CPU seconds. The other one starts much lower down. So the biggest change in planning in the last few years is really improving the search. Okay? The regression and progression that I taught you has been known for ages. Okay? And the current planners use either regression or progression. And are many of the other techniques. There's one, at least one other technique called plan space planning that I'm not describing here. It turns out that the major difference really is this heuristic information. Telling the planner, you know, in sort of an S-star search scenario, giving a good H function. Now, giving a good H function that doesn't cheat by kind of encoding everything about the domain as part of the H function. Okay, that's important because you still want to give to your planner the input, the only input that you give to your planner is the action and for each problem initial and goal state. That's it, nothing more. And the planner still has to figure out among the many children states it generated, which one should it go forward on if it's going progression and which one should it go backward on if it's going regression. Which is classic search, right? I mean, heuristic is supposed to tell you which of your children are not losers. And then you go forward on that. Okay, so really, it's the most important thing in terms of planning in the recent years. So, it's all about heuristics. So let me just make sure that we are all on the same page about how heuristics work in search. Okay, it's not the case that A-star search wasn't being taught before 95. I've been here since at least 91, and I've been teaching A-star search. People use heuristics. Okay, even before me, there were people. When the A-star search was like 1960s idea, okay, 1970s idea, and you know, people use heuristics. People use domain-independent heuristics. In fact, the previous picture, which just keeps changing on me, they all use heuristics. They would have in each of their papers like this much description about the heuristic that they have used. However, there was this mindset that somehow heuristic should be a cheap heuristic. Let me ask you guys did search, right? You did what? What search program did you do? Sudoku solver. So what sort of heuristics did you use? How much time did the heuristic computation take? Not come up with it. During the heuristic computation. So let me give you some other examples because all of you may have used different sorts of heuristics. Eight puzzle, you have discussed eight puzzles in the class. What was the kind of heuristics you discussed? Number of misplaced tiles. Ooh, that's like takes a long time to compute the number of misplaced tiles. Nothing. It just takes a few microseconds to compute the number of misplaced tiles. And a better heuristic is Manhattan distance heuristic, which adds up the Manhattan distance of number of misplaced tiles. So if you're thinking about the time you spend computing the heuristic, it's like cheap, it's peanuts. Okay? And unfortunately, you get what you pay for. And so, think of this picture. Suppose I have my x-axis where, you know, for this, any problem that you have in mind, okay, suppose eight puzzles, I come up with a bunch of heuristics. This is H1, this is H2, H3, H4, H19, H19,000, H-star. H-star, of course, is the very best heuristic, which is basically solve the problem and use the optimal cost from that as a heuristic. Okay. Now, if you ask yourself, for each of these heuristics, this y-axis is the time axis. How much time do you spend computing the heuristic? Misplaced tiles would be sort of here. And Manhattan distance will be sort of very close to it because it does a little more than that. H star, which is computing the optimal path for eight puzzle first and using it in the search, which is obviously a dumb idea, right? But it's worth talking about it because that's the perfect heuristic, would be somewhere out there, right? So that if you put these heuristics in terms of their complexity, here's another thing like this. Okay. Now, if you ask yourself, if you just count the amount of time you spent on the search itself, subtract the heuristic cost. Just the time you spent on the search, how do you think that search time would look like? For this heuristic, you're likely to do a lot of search. For this heuristic, you're likely to do very little search. So this thing is sort of something like this. I mean, the exact shape is not important. This will be much lower, this will be much higher. And similarly, this will be much lower, that will be much higher. So the question then is, what should I go with? these heuristics are somewhere in the middle. To understand that, you have to ask yourself, what are you being graded on? You're being graded on the total cost, which is the cost for computing the heuristics plus the cost for doing the search, which is addition of these two curves. Just add up these two curves at every x point, add up the two curves, and you get a new y value. And it's easy enough to see that that thing will look something more like this if these things were like this. As to what is the right amount of heuristic work you should do, the answer is this point, right here. Find the heuristic corresponding to this. That corresponds to the minimum amount of total work you spend. This is a conceptual view, you know, you cannot do it for a given problem. There's a reason why I'm telling you all this. You'll hopefully figure this out in a minute. So the important thing is that you're trying to compute the total, you're trying to reduce the total cost. That's the only thing that matters. Okay, so when you're trying to do like the marathon, it doesn't matter that you went the first 100 yards much faster than everybody else. But then you came 2 days later than the guy who completed the marathon. You know, that doesn't help because nobody cares who went first in the first 100 yards. Okay, so the total cost is what matters. So in this case, you're assuming that basically it ultimately depends on this point, and the question is, what would those, where do you think those heuristics would live? And a general point in AI, not just in planning, a general point in AI has been the realization that in the past, people used to believe that heuristics have to be cheap to compute. So there was this mindset, it's hard to describe, but the mindset was that these curves were such that this whole thing was somewhere here. That means you compute very cheap heuristics, use them in search. Those are the only ones you will try. You won't even try costly heuristics because you think they should not, they would probably not work for you. In the sense, the time you spend in computing them wouldn't be made up in the time, in the total time that you do. So people won't even try. Okay? And one of the interesting things is more and more we are seeing that in many problems, including planning and including 8 puzzles, you actually do well by doing much more work during the heuristic phase. Per node, if you spend a lot more time computing the heuristics, then you do much fewer nodes, and you actually win. Okay? In fact, the very best ideas for n puzzle problems, to the extent you're into n puzzle problems, are not, unfortunately, you know, not the misplaced tiles and Manhattan distance. There are these things called pattern databases. Have you heard of those? They essentially cache out the optimal paths for some sub-problems of the whole problem. And the sub-problems can be seen as the relaxation of the larger problem. And they spend like huge amount of time computing these pattern databases. And yet, they win overall. So currently, 24 puzzles, you guys write a problem, you guys write a star search and try to do a 24 puzzle problem, you die. You know, either you die or your machine dies because it runs out of memory. And now people actually solve them using pattern database heuristics. Okay, so the important thing, the bigger thing, which kind of transcends planning, is you should be looking at heuristics that are not very cheap to compute. I mean, don't have this, you know, mental blinder thinking that heuristics should be, you know, the kind of heuristics that all of you heard of are what? Straight line distance, which is how costly is this? X1 minus X2 square plus Y1 minus Y2 square, a big square root on top. You know, how much time does it take for an Intel processor, even a dumb one, to compute? Nothing. And yet, you know, you use that as a heuristic and you're trying to do path planning on the plane with obstacles, you don't do that well. So you're better off actually spending some time thinking, which is basically the heuristic. Okay? And the same thing, in fact, you almost did not hear about any lectures, I would bet, where most of the lecture was about the heuristics. You know, most of the lecture is good to have heuristics, but not how costly is it to compute a single heuristic. It turns out that today's entire lecture, you know, to the extent I have time, is all about just computing the heuristics. And so I'm sort of trying to justify myself to you, saying it's part of a bigger realization that, in fact, that sort of time is well spent. Okay? So in particular, for planning, the sort of heuristics people tried before were things like set deference heuristics. Which is the following. So if you're doing progression and you have a state and you're trying to figure out how far is it from the goal state, which has g1, g2, g3, you take the set difference between, think of this as a set with elements, you take the set difference between this set and this set, which is basically the number of goals that are not present in this state. So if this one has g1 and nothing else, then it has heuristic cost 2. And if there is somebody else which has g2 and g3 but not g1, it has heuristic cost 1. So your planning algorithm will try to go forward on this. Now these goals could be, for example, g1 be a millionaire, g2 get a paper, a newspaper, not real conference paper, and g3 have a cup of coffee. These were your three goals. Okay. And this guy is missing the be a millionaire part. Okay, and this guy has the be a millionaire part. Knowing the way domain works, which do you think is actually a way good, way better search state to go forward on? This one. Because anybody can get a cup of coffee. I mean, especially in millionaire, you get too many coffee places. And anybody can also get a newspaper. There's very small plans that you can use to get those. But the plans to become millionaires are unfortunately few and far between. So there is a differential weight to these goals, and you don't see that if you're using set difference heuristic. Okay? Now, I don't want to cheat by saying, by the way, being millionaire is much harder than buying a paper. Okay? I mean, some random other world, maybe the opposite is true. I don't know. Okay? So I want my planner to figure this out as part of its heuristic computation. That's what I want to do. Okay. So this is all of whatever I said is written in beautiful handwriting here. So we'll do the heuristic now, which is not set difference heuristic because I already yelled at it, so I'm not going to do it. So this is a point I made earlier, that for progression search, you need information about relevance, which is how far is this state from the goal state. So how far is the partial state from the goal state. Each child state in the queue, how far is it from the goal state? That's what you want to know. For regression search, on the other hand, you want the opposite information. How far is this state from the initial state? Really, both of these can be thought of as reachability information. That means, how far is it to reach from wherever I am to a particular state. Okay. In the case of progression, wherever I am is my partial state, I want to reach the goal state. In the case of regression, I am in this state, I want to reach the initial state. So I want to compute the distance in terms of number of moves. This is basically the idea of reachability information. So if I can give you the reachability information, I can solve planning problems very fast. So the H star for planning would be perfect reachability information. You should know what's the perfect information so that you can find approximations to it. Okay, a star for planning would be the perfect reachability information. So for each state I give you, if you're in a progression search, it should give what is the shortest path from that state in terms of number of actions to the goal state. Okay? So one important point I'm making here is that both of these are really reachability. You know, it's just the direction differs. So I would just, for the rest of this talk, rest of this class, I'll just talk about reachability heuristics in terms of computing the distance from some state to a given goal state. And then you can use it in the forward direction or the reverse direction based on whether you're doing progression or regression. Okay, so I'll only talk about one main idea for heuristics. Here, always understand the dumb way of doing things before you can appreciate the good way of doing it. Okay, so the dumb way of doing it, which will actually work, to compute the reachability information is to, so suppose I am in a particular state and I want to figure out how far is that state to the goal state. Okay, so the picture I have in mind is this. So I have, for now I'll just think in terms of progression. So there is a tree and there is a fringe to this tree okay, let's say, and these are all my nodes in the search queue. These are all the states that are sitting in the search queue asking the search algorithm, pick me, and expand me. Okay. The search algorithm is trying to figure out which one to pick. That's what it's trying to do. So the way it will do it is, for each of these four guys, he'll try to, the heuristic, he'll ask the heuristic, which is a rich uncle, how far is this guy from the goal state, how far is this guy from the goal state, and whichever the rich uncle says is closer to the goal state, in some sense, that will win. Now, if you want to do A star search, you will also add to that the path length here, which is the G value. G plus H would be your evaluation point. Okay, so this state is one of these states here, Okay, I picked it and I'm trying to estimate how far is it from the goal state. Okay, one obvious way is do projection from this state. Basically, do complete progression from this state. Okay, develop a nice big tree until you reach the goal state. Okay, until you reach the goal state, and then if one of these is the goal state, then you just know what is the distance. Okay, obviously a dumb idea because you're doing planning all over again at each node as against just at the higher level. The question, of course, is can I find approximation to this perfect value in a cheap way? Okay, and I will talk to you about a specific approximation, which looks sort of like this. So the bottom is this idea called a planning graph, which sort of gives you approximate reachability information. Okay, and I sort of, you know, follow me, and that's the way planning graph gets defined. Okay. The top, of course, is your progression tree. And I put them side by side because you'll start seeing why did I come up with planning graph. You know, because there are some connections, obvious connections. So if I was doing progression, I would have basically gone from P, I would have considered each action separately, generated each child separately. If I'm doing planning graph instead, what I would do is I would consider each action, and basically if this A1 here, I will put A1, put its effect here, which is a Q, A1 gives Q, so I put it here. And I'll put a link from A1 to P saying, well, you know, A1 requires P to be done, it's a precondition, and it gives Q. Here is A2 requiring P and it gives R. Here is A3 requiring P, it gives F. The difference is they were all different states. Okay? Here, one list. I just sort of removed the boundaries in this membranes were kind of collated out. Okay, so it has this, I put a big circle around all the states. Okay. Now this is not a state. This is not actually a state. However, it has some nice connections to real states. So for example, is every subset of this, I'll call this proposition list. That's the terminology that's used in planning graphs. I call this proposition list and these are states. My question is every sort of the approximate idea here is that the subset of the proposition list corresponds to states there. That's true, right? Every state here, PR, PR, PS, PS, PQ, PQ. So real states correspond to subsets of the proposition list. So real states reachable by K levels correspond to subsets of the proposition list at the kth level of the planning graph. In this case, k equal to 1. Okay? So the question then is this opposite, is the converse also true? So real state corresponds to subsets. Are subsets, are all subsets real states? If that's the case, then there's something weird going on because, you know, that guy is spending a lot more time, and so I would spend just as much time doing planning graph. Okay? So the question is, are there subsets here which don't correspond to any real state? Yeah, no, PQR, there's no state called PQR here. And yet that's a subset here. Now why would that sort of a thing happen? Why that sort of a thing happens partly is because you are assuming that all these actions can be done together. And it's possible that actions cannot be done together. It's possible that, you know, the actions have interactions. That means they can't be done at the same time. Okay? So, for example, suppose there is A which requires P and gives Q but deletes P. And then there is B which also requires P and gives R. I can't do A and B together at the same time, because this guy is killing one of the preconditions this guy needs. I'm ignoring that. By ignoring that, I'm making my life much simpler. So these sort of interactions where actions which cannot be done together, I mean certain actions cannot be done together, you can think of them as negative interactions between actions. I mean they don't let them get along. These actions would like to get along, but for this problem. Those are the negative interactions. So we are ignoring the negative interactions. That's basically what we are doing. Okay? And because of which, the price we pay is the subset that we think corresponds, every subset here is not a real state. However, every real state is a subset here. Is this useful information? Let me just go forward a couple more. So then, you know, at the higher level, this guy would have continued. And in the lower level, in fact, when I'm doing this, I don't look at that thing at all. I just do this. The reason I'm putting that there is so that you can see the connection. Okay? So in this case, again, I put all the actions and all this, all the actions whose preconditions are true in the previous proposition list, and all the effects of those actions. And sometimes notice that certain things will have multiple links. So for example, Q here could either be given by A1, or it could be given by Q here, and you didn't do anything. You have Q true and you don't do anything, Q will be true later. In fact, this is one thing that you do pretty much everywhere. P was true, if you didn't do anything, P would be true here too. Which is a reasonable thing. You know, if you have something, and if you don't do anything, and you know, if nobody else does anything, and in classical planning, nobody else does anything, right? Because there are no other agents. You're the only guy. So if you hold on to it, it'll be with you. If you don't do anything, you know, that's one way of keeping your money. You know, get the money and not spend, and you'll have the money next year too. Okay, modular inflation, but inflation basically assumes there are other people who are driving down the economy while you are holding on to your money. Okay, so this is my structure. So, for example, every state here corresponds to a subset of the proposition list here, but every subset here doesn't necessarily correspond to a state here. My question is this structure useful? First question, actually, maybe zeroth question is this structure cheaper to compute than this? This is an exponential time structure. This is a polynomial time structure. Okay? So it's way cheaper to compute than this. But it's still hairy compared to set difference heuristic, which is so much easier to understand, but doesn't work. Okay, so the question then is, why is this, so this is easier to compute. It sort of seems to be having some connections to reachability, right? Because if a state here, all the states that are reachable at two levels are subset of the proposition list at two levels, at the second level, but not vice versa. Why is this structure useful in what we want to do? Suppose I want to know, for example, suppose I want to know, my goal state is G1 and G5, let's say. Okay? I can do the following thing. Go to the kth level proposition list and check if G1, G5 is a subset of that proposition list. If it ain't, should I be happy or not? Should be happy. If it's not, that means this is kth level, right? So this is first, second. So you know, if G1, G2 is not present here, that means the cost of achieving G1, G2 starting from here is at least 2. At least 2. It may be much more than 2, but it's at least 2. If it's not even present in the 15th level, it's at least 15. Right? Furthermore, if it is present, but the opposite of course is not true, in the sense, if it is present in the third level, I mean in the second level, if G1, G2 were present here, it doesn't necessarily mean that the plan for making G1, G2 is exactly 2 steps long. It only means 2 is an lower bound of the cost. Now, where did you hear lower bound? Heuristics are all lower bound. Heuristics are all lower bound. Okay? You get lower bound heuristics, those are the good ones, those are the admissible heuristics. So, in fact, this is a nice picture to keep in mind. Suppose I write all my nodes in the search tree, N1, etc., up to N million in the x-axis, and I write the heuristic cost, the cost, estimated cost to goal on the y-axis. Now, this, let's say, is h star. So, for example, this means that for this node, exact cost for going from this node to the goal state is whatever this number is. That's the exact cost. That's the optimal cost. No more, no less. Okay, this is your H star. Admissible heuristics live where? They all live below this guy. That's it. Okay, any curve that you can think of which is below that is an admissible heuristic. And so the curve, this curve, is also an admissible heuristic. That happens to be equal to H equal to 0. And you know that breadth first search is optimal because it uses this as a heuristic. And any, when you are trying to say that a heuristic is admissible, in essence you are constructing a proof that the function corresponding to that heuristic is always dominated by the H star function. So lower bounds are admissible heuristics. And the way you make heuristic better and better, of course, is this notion of informedness. If I have a heuristic which is sort of like this, and another heuristic which is sort of like this, then I say this is better. Because it's a better lower bound, it's closer to the optimal value. And this is basically the notion of more informed, less informed heuristic. Okay, and of course, if I have a heuristic which is like this, that is not admissible because it crosses the H star in some points. So it's not admissible. It's a global property. Admissibility is a global property. If you mess up your estimate for even one node, you are not admissible. Okay? And this is another interesting thing. Inadmissible heuristics may sometimes give you optimal solutions. But the issue of optimality is, unlike correctness, optimality is a global property. If I give you a plan and say, is this a good plan? Is this a correct plan? You can check that. You know, you start from the initial state, apply the first action, apply the second action next, apply the third action, and to the N actions. Check the state. If that satisfies goals, then it's a correct plan. It doesn't matter where you get it. It's a correct plan. If I show you a plan and say, is this an optimal plan, you have no hope of telling me in 3 seconds whether it's optimal or not, because optimality depends on what other things were there in the search tree. So it has to be the case that if you want to give optimality, it better be true out of the box. Saying sometimes optimal is that like saying nothing. Because which times are you optimal? I don't know. You know, check. Check is basically dead. Okay? I mean, these are again important points in terms of admissibility of heuristics and the notion as to why we try to prove the optimality up front rather than, I mean, we are not saying that when a heuristic is inadmissible, it won't get you optimal solutions. It's just that you can't be sure. In fact, this is interesting for us because several of the heuristics I'll be discussing in a minute are inadmissible. And that, you know, huge performance that I showed you, many of the planners that do that well actually use inadmissible heuristics. Okay, but empirically, they do quite well. And the way you figure out that they do quite well is if you have an optimal planner, you run that, and you compare that guy's solution to this guy. In competitions, this can be done. Except the optimal planner dies after the first three problems, most of the time, because admissible heuristics are much harder to come by. Okay, and so then you become Google, because there is no optimal anybody, so it's your guess against mine, and I think it's admissible. I mean, I think it's optimal. Are you going to, you know, question me? Of course not, you know. I mean, if you are inoptimal compared to Yahoo, then it's clearly inoptimal, okay, because Yahoo is better than you. But if you are better than Yahoo, that doesn't mean that you are optimal anything. Okay, so inadmissible heuristics are what most search algorithms actually wind up using. But it's worth knowing the importance of being a computer scientist versus a programmer is both of you will write code which will do whatever it needs to do to get by. Except a computer scientist will prove a theorem saying, well, under these conditions it would be optimal. I know what optimality is, but I have decided to give up on it. Okay, and a general programmer has no clue. They might actually get optimality or not get optimality. They have no clue as to what is the theory behind it. Okay. Anyway, so in this case, what you have is lower bound information. In particular, I have the following idea called a state level heuristic. First of all, I call it basically an idea. Let me see. Okay, these are more slides showing how planning graphs are constructed. So for example, for blocks world, you could do, you know, a planning graph which might look like this. And planning graphs are painful to construct on paper. Okay, and so it's great exam questions. You know, we can stump you, you know, and you start doing your planning graph and the time is over. But they're extremely easy for computers. You know, rote stuff is bad for us, but darn easy for computers. Okay. And in fact, but, okay, so in computing, so this is another important slide, which is basically how to get the heuristics out of this planning graph. All we are saying is, if you need to compute, suppose your goal is a single literal. Okay, this particular one is a planning graph for our problem, the block solve problem that we are looking at. If your goal is a single literal, here's my idea. Look for the first proposition level at which that single literal appears. Okay, the levels are numbered 0, 1, 2, so on. Okay, the first proposition level that where this proposition occurs, this literal occurs, and the index of that level is the cost. That's it. That's your heuristic cost. Add that to your G value, do your search. Okay? And if you have multiple literals, things become more interesting. If you have a set of literals that whose cost you are trying to compute, there are possible ways of doing it. One way, of course, is act as if each literal in the set is isolated, compute its cost, think of them as independent, so add their cost up. So P is 1, let's say Q appears in the first level, P appears in the first level, R appears in the second level. So 1 plus 1 plus 2 is 4. That's the cost I'm going to use. This makes the assumption that the set of goals is independent. Here's actually an interesting point. Let's look at this. Suppose I have N goals, K goals, pi2, pk. And these, all of them have known costs, to make our life simple, one. Each of them are one unit costly. If you just have that goal, it's one unit costly. Tell me, what do I know about the cost of the set pi to pk and p1 to pk? Do you understand what I'm saying? So if I can do this goal alone, so for example, my goals are, let's say, get a paper. You know, that's my goal. So I will say, get up, walk, go to the shop, pick the paper. That's the plan for that. And since there are four actions, it's four costly. Okay? Get a candy. That's get up, walk, go to the shop, pick a candy. That's four actions, four costly. Now my new goal is get a paper and a candy. Right? And you don't want to be like Newton. I think Newton is the guy who basically wanted some carpenter to come and make two doors in his home, for one for his dog and one for his cat. Okay? So one door through which dog can come through, one door through which cat can come through, and the carpenter was trying to explain to this great scientist that, you know, reuse is possible. You know, that the one that dog comes through, cat can use it too. Okay? There is a positive interaction, and of course they don't want to get through at the same time, they can't stand each other, but you really can get by with one door. And similarly for the candy example, I don't need to walk twice to the store. The first three actions of going up to the store are common for both these goals. Okay? And then I just pick a candy as well as pick a paper. So 3 plus 2, 5 is real cost of getting paper as well as candy. Whereas previously, if you assume they were completely independent, you would think it will be 4 plus 4, 8, which is an overestimate because they have positive interactions. You say that a set of goals are positively interacting if achieving them together is cheaper than achieving them separately and concatenating the plan. If I have positive interactions on one side and I have independence on the other side, which basically means achieving one goal doesn't do anything to achieve the other goal. So for example, get a newspaper and in common sense world, give me an independent goal of getting a newspaper, from getting a newspaper. Think of something.
Running a mile.
Going to eat, 7-Eleven sells both papers and candy.
Running a mile.
That might unfortunately will have positive interactions. You know, I can run to the... So, yeah, you can think of something. I don't know what... What? Yeah, I mean, yeah, this is the problem with common sense examples. So, because, you know, 7-Eleven sometimes might allow you to use the restroom. But you get the drift. I mean, you can come up with some thing, you know, like say a good thing to your wife, for example. That's another, I mean, if you have one, you know, if you have none, I'd help you. But that might not work. But anyway, so the thing is, these are independent goals. Getting newspaper isn't necessarily going to make your girlfriend, and most girlfriends or wives, happy. In fact, they're going to be not happy, you know, because you're not going to read your sports section. That's not going to be good. Okay? So in some sense, actually, independent means the fact that you achieved one has no impact on the fact that you achieved the other. Now, there's a third possibility, which is negatively interacting, which is have fun and get a good grade. Sort of that. No. In fact, having fun, extremely easy to do. There's a plan for it. Getting a good grade, there's a plan for it. Getting both is kind of hard. So in fact, it's possible that in terms of Bloch's world, on AB and on BA, getting on AB alone, two-step plan. Getting on BA alone, two-step plan. It's like I'm sounding like that Visa commercial. Getting on AB and on BA, priceless. Basically, it's infinitely costly. You can't make them true. Do you understand what I'm saying? These are two goals which are hugely negatively interacting. So the reality is that if you know the values of the individual literals, okay, and if you sum them all up, then you are making an assumption about the goal. The assumption is you are assuming that they're independent. It's like cat closing its eyes and saying, I'm assuming there's nobody in the world. You know, if in fact there's nobody in the world, cat lucks out. If not, it loses. Okay, and so if in fact the goals are independent, you luck out and your heuristic would be good heuristic. If they are actually not, you lose. And if they are positively interacting, your heuristic would be a what? It would be an overestimate of the cost. So you would become inadmissible. If they are negatively interacting, your heuristic would be a huge underestimate. So either way, you die. I mean, you know, the good life exists close to this guy. Way above it, way below it, not good. Okay, so that's why computing the cost of a set of literals given the cost of independent pieces is a non-trivial problem. So and there are two ideas that people try. One is, let's assume they're all independent. Okay, and so you add up all their costs. The other is, let's assume they're all positively interacting And so look at the first level at which the entire set is present. Not pieces of it, but the entire set is present together. So it may be that you are looking for G1, G2. G1 is present in the first level. G2 comes into being only at the fourth level. So G1, G2 will be present first at fourth level. Because once somebody comes in into the planning graph, it doesn't go away. Did you notice that? The way we are planning graphs are, they are tenure system. Once you get in, you never have to get out. Because once you are there, this no-op action which will make you persist to all other layers. Okay, so G1 comes in at the first level, G5 comes in at the fourth level. Finding the first level where G1, G5 comes is equivalent to finding the maximum of the two levels. So that's called a max heuristic. One is called a sum heuristic, which is summing up. The other is called a max heuristic, which is maxing over both those numbers. Now, a third idea is the following. You know, look, you want that and this, right? Let's think of this graph as the space of plans and try to extract a plan from this graph which supports both those goals. In doing so, try to, for example, make sure that if you already picked an action which is supporting one of the goals and it also supports the second goal, then don't pick a different action because this one guy is supporting both. So this idea it's actually a very interesting idea here. Now we are saying in the planning graph, you extract a plan to support your goal literals. So previously you are finding levels for each of the literals and then combining them either by sum or max. But now I'm saying, actually, start from HB. You know that somebody has to support HB. And similarly, somebody has to support this guy. Now, in the planning graph, the only guys that can support those propositions are those, there are incident edges. Only one of those edges has to be picked. Okay? So basically, you pick one edge for HB, one edge for RTB. As soon as you pick, let's say, this edge, in essence, you picked this guy as the supporter for RAB, untable B. Now, this one is saying put down B. The moment this is part of the plan, all its preconditions come into the plan. You can't do this action unless you do HB at this level. So, to make RAB true here, you have to make HB true here. And to make HB true here, you pick any of the guys who can support HB. For example, pick B can support HB. And then if you pick B, then its preconditions have to be supported. But this is the initial state, so its preconditions are already true in the initial state. Okay? Do this for all the goals. Trying as best as you can to reuse actions that have already been picked up to support somebody else. You can just be greedy. So pick, you know, a goal and pick an action for supporting it. Pick the second goal to see if any of the already picked actions can also support it. If so, don't do anything. Say it's picked up, it's been taken care of. And pick the third goal and so on. And when all the goals at this level are picked up, you would have picked up a bunch of actions at this level, which means you have picked up a bunch of preconditions to be satisfied at this level. So you do the same thing you did there, but here now. It's a nice recursive procedure. Very nice recursive procedure. How hard is finding this kind of a plan from the planning graph? It turns out that if you want to just find a plan, it's linear time. If you want to find the optimal plan, that is the plan which has the least number of actions being used, for example, that can be complete. Okay, so we say to heck with it, we'll just find a plan, which is linear. And that idea essentially, so and that plan, once you pick that plan, is that a plan for the overall problem? No. Because this whole structure ignored negative interactions. It's assuming that all actions can be done together, even when they cannot actually be done together. So the solution you have here is a relaxed solution. It's a solution for the relaxed problem. Okay? It's like a solution in the 8 puzzle problem where you assume that everything can move, you know, even over obstacles. And so the relaxed solution, the length of the relaxed solution then becomes the heuristic value for your base search. So there's a base level search, and this is the heuristic level search. Now, if I didn't tell you previously that heuristics can be taking a full lecture to explain and still do well, you would have believed me. And all I said was intimidated you into thinking that other people have done that and they've done. And more importantly, in fact, the state-of-the-art planners, which do the kind of performance I showed you earlier, essentially use this heuristic. That's it. Okay? So just to get this into your head, I'll come back to that in a minute. This is basically what they're doing. For each node here, it's computing a planning graph, picking a relaxed plan. For this node, computing a planning graph, picking a relaxed plan. For this node, picking a computing a planning graph, picking a relaxed plan. Taking those lengths, those are the H values, okay? And adding those H values to the G values and picking the one with the best F value. This is one step in your search. Any day, if you have to write a planning program, you would rather write set difference heuristics. You know, that's way better. You know, who would have learned AVL trees? Did you guys do AVL trees in data structures? Height balance trees? What did you guys do? Anyway, so, I mean, there's this concept called height balance trees in data structure. We used to teach it. Maybe, I guess, we decided we are too far advanced to teach now. It's way much harder. It takes like a whole lecture to explain compared to binary trees, which anybody can explain. And if I have to write the AVL trees, it's more painful. You know, the code for AVL trees is more painful than the code for binary trees. But who cared about what's painful for you? What matters is which is the faster algorithm. And AVL trees, because they balance the height, they can have much better performance in terms of lookup. That's similar idea. Okay, those kinds of ideas. So again, the point I'm making here is you do all this because, in fact, it does well in practice. And I want to just add one point in the end to sort of say something interesting connected to this class. Back in 1999 or 2000, I forget, we were actually doing set difference heuristic for a planner in the third project of the CSC 471 course. And around that time, this planning graph structure was introduced as part of a different planner called GraphPlan. And it's a completely different algorithm. The only point that is connected is that it actually computes the planning graph and searches for a subgraph which corresponds to a valid plan. And the only thing that's different in GraphPlan and this relaxed plan extraction is that it also can say if you pick two actions at a level and they have a mutual exclusion, that means they can't live together, then you have to backtrack. This search is backtrack free. That's why it's linear time. Whereas once you have mutual exclusions, you would have to backtrack, and that makes, you know, the search much costlier. But that's one way of generating plans. And this idea of planning graphs came as part of the graph plan search. And I suggested to some students that maybe you could try. We had a graph plan code. We suggested that maybe there were other things that are happening in the field. And we said, let's try planning graph based heuristics. Okay. And in fact, one student looking just like you actually tried it and continued doing work on that, wrote an MS thesis. And in fact, your textbook, essentially, the chapter in the textbook on these heuristics is written based on that work. In fact, the lecture notes came from this course. Part of this is to show that I'm smart. but part of it is also to show that AI is the only area where you can take introductory AI course and get into the textbook. Okay? Try doing this in physics. Take physics 101 and try to get into the textbook. You know, everything worth doing has been done, unfortunately. I mean, the useful things that are left are at physics 907 or something, you know, and whereas one of the beautiful points about some of the relatively young areas is you can make a difference. Okay? So somebody who's done 471 actually did something which basically is very close to the idea that I described in the class today. So that's as close as you can get to the state of the art in a four-level course. So there are two parting comments for today's class. Am I coming next time? What is the story?
No, it's up to you, but I didn't plan.
Okay, you didn't plan. So let me make two comments, and I know this is kind of getting late. One is that, what were the two comments? I guess part of the reason I gave this lecture, stealing Vandu's time, is he said there are people with good brains here. And he may be mistaken. You might have been doing a good job in deceiving him. But if people are interested in this kind of stuff, I have undergraduate research opportunities, NSF-funded things. I have money, which I'll just return to NSF because I don't currently have smart enough students I wanted to work with. So if any of you are interested, come and talk to me. Okay, that's one point. The other point that I wanted to make is there are a bunch of homework problems based on these topics that I put up on the web. And I know that some of you have been looking for the solutions and finding that they don't exist. I mean, there's a solution link, and I have already seen 15 people click on it. And I have done web for a longer time than you guys did. So I have changed the written write permissions, which I will put it back once the homework due date is done. I suggest that you try to do them to make sure that you understand what we discussed here. Okay, thanks. Which, as you know, is harder.